Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I'm back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And before we get into today's great guest, I want to remind everybody to go to my website. I've got a lot of cool stuff going on. We are recording this podcast today on the 27th of January. I've got exactly 2 months, 3 days, 22 hours, 55 minutes, and 8 seconds before I head off to Mount Everest. I'm so excited to take on that crazy challenge. You can follow the journey. There's a little tab I put up there now, says follow the journey. And you can actually see me with a Garmin app going up and down the mountain, which will be pretty spectacular. I also have a blog that will reporting day-to-day activities as much as I can on this epic effort. Okay, so please check out there. Also on that same website, you can check out my philanthropy. Many of you know I've been fundraising for Amelia's Everest, the Losi Challenge. My daughter has epilepsy, so a lot of the podcast is inspired around her, what she's doing. By a partner with Higher Ground, they're here in Sun Valley, Los Angeles, and New York, and we have come together to fundraise for many of the people in the military with cognitive issues and adaptive issues that they've had in the past. And so together, we've raised over $36,000 so far, which has been great. The original goal was $27,940, which represents the height of Lhotse, which is the mountain just to the side of Mount Everest, which I will also be trying to take on at the same time. And of course, this is where you can find all my podcasts, as well as on iTunes and other places. I would so appreciate a ratings and review, if you would. It absolutely has everything to do with the popularity on iTunes when people do give ratings and reviews. So please go check that out. We've got absolutely incredible people doing amazing things in today's market. And on that note, I want to bring in my first guest, my only guest, the best guest so far of the day. I'm so excited about this person because of his story is truly remarkable. His name is Jerry Schimmel. Jerry, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Mark. How are you?
Man, I'm doing great. I mean, you've got such an incredible career, and we're going to get into it. And you know, what I want to do is kind of start at the tip of the iceberg, because you've got so many different bullet points. You know, when I was reading this, and I do have a number of people that come to me, and when they come to me, I evaluate it. Like, are they just trying to sell a bit book, or are they just really authentic about who they are? And to actually sit here and talk to somebody who survived a major plane crash that killed 112 people just blows my mind. And you know, that is it's become a big part of your life, like it would for anybody who survived and walked out of the back end of a plane that's just been split in half. United Airlines 232 that crash landed in Sioux City in Iowa. And I can't imagine that. And then you've got this long career as a play-by-play broadcaster in professional basketball. And then you've got this love of the outdoors, of riding, of challenging yourself, of taking a bike across the U.S. But I want to start with kind of the most chilling thing, at least for me. I'm about ready, as we just talked about, to jump on a plane to fly from LAX to Dubai, from Dubai to Kathmandu, from Kathmandu into this little airport. It's supposed to be the deadliest airport in the world, called Lukka. And it's a short runway that actually goes uphill when you land. And then when you take off, you actually go off a cliff, and then the plane, you have to bank hard left because there's a mountain in the back. So like, this gives me chills when we're even talking about it. But can we go back? And I know you've told this story a lot, and I'm asking you just to, you know, go back one more time. I saw this really inspiring piece on ESPN that was done on you, really well done, that kind of relived that moment. And just for the audience, so they can understand kind of like your where were you going? Why were you in that plane? And then like, how did that whole thing unfold?
Yeah. Well, first of all, Mark, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. I'm honored to do that. I think the role should be reversed. I should be interviewing you for something like this with your story. I've got a radio show, and I've had three different people on it who have done the Seven Summits. So I'm really, really anxious for you to complete yours. But to answer your question, yeah, United Airlines Flight 232, happened July 19, 1989. And I was working back then, Mark, for the Continental Basketball Association, which is the NBA's minor league system. And the office is based in Denver back then. It was a flight that was originating in Denver. We were bound for Chicago. We got about halfway there over Northwest Iowa when we had an explosion aboard this plane. And the plane was a jumbo jet. It was a DC-10. 296 people were aboard, completely full. And the first thing I thought was a bomb had gone off. Honestly, I did. I thought a terrorist had planted a bomb. It had been detonated. We started to drop. And I thought that was it for everybody. I thought we were going to just drop to the ground. That would be it. But we came out of that drop, and a couple minutes later, it leveled off again. Found out that the plane had blown an engine, the number two engine, the DC-10, and severed the entire hydraulic system, which left the engine completely gone. It basically blew out the back of the engine compartment. But the cockpit crew tried to get us to Sioux City. The cockpit crew had so little control of the plane, and a normal DC-10 landing is about 120 miles an hour when you touch the ground. They couldn't slow the plane down, so we hit at 255 miles an hour, which by itself is disaster. You can't land a plane that big at that airspeed. So hit the ground, we flipped over, plane broke into all kinds of pieces, big and small. After we flipped over, we slid another 4,000 feet, so over a mile from start to finish, ended up at a cornfield in next to the airport in Sioux City. And the result was that 112 people died, as you said. 184 of us survived, but 112 died. And I was one of the lucky ones. Everybody around me in the crash died. The guy on my left, sitting to my left, died. The little boy in front of me, the woman across the aisle to my right, and the guy behind me all perished in the crash. And I came out without any serious injuries. So miraculous that we got to Sioux City, Mark, number one, and certainly miraculous that I was able to survive like I did.
So there's a lot of pieces in there that I want to ask you about. When you just talked about, there's a lot of people around you that unfortunately perished. Was it because a piece of the seat happened to pierce their chest, or was it because of the impact? You had the same impact, but for whatever reason, your body was able to absorb that versus theirs weren't. Were you still in your seat? Were you upside down? I mean, why were you spared when others weren't within feet of you?
I think the best explanation is that my chair didn't give. I stayed in my seat. My seatbelt stayed intact. My chair stayed intact. Most of the people around me either got thrown from their seat or actually were thrown in their seat. Their seat had dislodged and they were thrown in it. That was in my area. Now, United Airlines came out later and said that almost half the people died of smoke inhalation, which I think certainly could have happened in other parts of the plane. The piece I was in, that wasn't the case. We had a lot of smoke, but I think most people have perished in our little section, which was about 50 people, and half of us lived and half of us didn't, was because of the impact. Because we came to stop, to answer your question, I'm hanging upside down. I'm in my chair, seatbelt's intact, and I had to drop down to the ceiling now because you're upside down. And when I looked around, there wasn't anybody else around me. Everybody had to be either thrown in their seats or thrown from their seats. And I think that's why I was able to survive, was I just, for some reason, was one of the lucky ones who had his seat stay intact.
As they make this first announcement, and you describe it as maybe a bomb going off, and then there's a automatic, you know, drop, and then you kind of stabilize and you're going around in the air for the next 45 minutes trying to figure out how you're actually going to land this thing and where you're going to land it. And then the pilots actually, you know, make that attempt. As you're going down, I can't imagine what people are going through. I would imagine that you're in the crash position that they always talk about. You know, your head's more or less in the seat of your legs, and you're just bracing. And you know, I don't know if you're saying prayers or you're thinking like, "What if?" or "You're going to survive." I mean, what's going on in your mind as that all plays out?
Yeah, we had such a crazy circumstance because we had a lot of time before we hit. Most of these major airline disasters, something happens immediately, there's chaos and there's a crash, but ours strung out for 45 minutes. And the reason for that was they were trying an emergency landing in Sioux City, and every time they got a heading for the airport, the plane on its own would sort of veer off to the right. They had to come back and line up again. So we did that five times, and that's why it took us so long. And we were able to actually practice the emergency landing procedures, not once, but twice. We went through it with the flight attendant. So they told us the brace position. You're right, is put your forehead in the seat back in front of you, cross your arms, hold on the seat back in front, the tuck position, as they call it. So we were about as ready as we could be. And I think in those 45 minutes, I thought about everything, Mark. I think I thought about a myriad of things. I thought about, you know, my life to that point. I was 29 years old. I thought, well, if I'm not going to survive, and I led a pretty good life, you know, I had a great marriage. My wife and I had been married 4 years and didn't have kids yet, but had a great marriage, had a great little career. So if I'm going to go, it might not be a bad time to go. And then I thought, man, I can't think that way. I got to think that, well, my thought was, hey, if you're dead, you're not going to do anything. But if you're not, and this crash happens, don't panic. Don't flee the plane. Don't help yourself. Stay in and help other people. And those thoughts paid off, because that's what we all did. I think we all kind of stayed calm, at least in my area, and helped each other.
Okay, so now the plane comes to a standstill. You're in your chair. You're hanging upside down, probably suspended by your seatbelt. And now you unbuckle. To get out of the plane, had the plane literally like come apart in two, just like if I were to take my hands and rip apart a Coke can?
That's exactly what happened. Yeah. And actually ended up in four big pieces. There was the first class a little bit behind that, the middle of the cabin, and then toward the back where we were, and then the tail section. So four big pieces, and all were about the same. They all had about 50 people or so in them, 50 to 60. And yeah, so I'm hanging upside down, and you know what, I had to figure out, we came to stop because we slid for a long time. We slid for 4,000 feet upside down and backwards. I came to stop, and my seat back, I kind of slammed my back of my head into the seat back and got a whiplash from that. But I had to figure out if I was alive or not, to be honest, Mark. And I got out of my seat. I'm standing on the ceiling of the plane, and I felt pain in the back of my right hand. I looked down, there was fire kind of shooting from a wall to my right and caught the back of my knuckle. And I thought, well, if I'm feeling pain, I must be alive. And so that was the best pain I've ever felt in my life, by the way. And then I just thought, you know, react to the circumstance. The smoke was coming from the front of the plane to the back. So I really had no choice but turn around and go backward. And that's where I encountered some other survivors.
You now exit the plane, and as you exit the plane, you hear this baby crying. And so you, as it's just a natural instinct, you don't even think twice about it. You turn around. Now you go, you know, after you've gone through this, you've gone through this ordeal for 45 minutes, all this stuff going through your mind, you hit the ground, the plane breaks up in four different pieces, and you're one of the lucky few who actually make it through all this. You exit the plane, but now you go back into the plane. I mean, were there second thoughts about this, or like how did that all play out?
None, actually. I was probably in the cabin initially about 2 or 3 minutes, and then the smoke just forces out, and I saw this hole to the outside, and so I saw people going through it, so I followed them to the outside, and I think I might have been the last person that was alive, at least the ones that were moving to get out of the wreckage. And you know what happened, Mark? It just sort of happened. I didn't think it through. I didn't weigh any risk at all. I got outside the plane. I heard a baby crying back inside the wreckage. And the next thing I remember, I'm back inside the plane. I didn't think about it. I didn't turn it around and look and, you know, weigh the odds or anything. It just sort of happened. The next thing I remember, I'm on all fours over top of the crying. And I pulled a little baby, 11-month old girl, out of the overhead compartment of the plane because we were upside down. So she was below me. And so as I grabbed her, she stopped crying, and then I found the opening, got outside the plane the second time. And I know that, and I don't want to downplay what I did, Mark, and I don't want to be overly humble about it, but I came out of the crash labeled as hero, and that never felt appropriate to me. It really didn't, because I didn't think it through. It just sort of happened. I'm glad it did. I'm glad I heard the crying, and I'm glad I found myself back in the plane, but I didn't do anything heroic. And I think anybody else in that situation would have done the same thing. I mean, you think about it, we all know we're going to crash. We're in a plane full of kids. What are you going to do if you're a baby crying? Going to run away? No, you're going to stop and you're going to help. And that's what I did.
I think that question becomes more relevant when time has elapsed and you have time to think about what would you do in that situation versus like when I used to play football. I mean, this is a totally different example, but you're reacting in the moment, you know. Yeah. You're not thinking about what if I score a touchdown, will I stand up and, you know, take my helmet off? I mean, it's just all these things just happen real time. And that sounds like exactly, you know, what you did. Now, I tell me if this is correct. I heard that there was a moment in time afterwards where the survivors would come together and kind of hold hands and say a prayer and be thankful and pay respects for that moment that you guys all lived through. And the girl that you happened to save at kind of a tragic end at the end of the day. You want to tell more about that?
Yeah, we did. We had reunions. We had one, I think, 6 months after the crash. We had another one at a year. I think United Airlines or Sioux City, Iowa had a 2 year. Yeah, United Airlines kind of helped us get together a little bit. And then the 1 year anniversary of the crash, Sioux City, the city of Sioux City, brought everybody back that wanted to come. So we had those reunions. And then, you know, we started meeting after that a little bit more, Mark, and the numbers kind of dissipated a little bit. And then we kind of stopped meeting altogether, which is great. We didn't need to do that anymore. We needed to do it at the beginning, but not at the end. And then Sabrina Michelson, the little girl that I grabbed, you're right, not the script that I would write for her life, but she died of a drug overdose in 2009, I believe, 2009. Not sure if it was accidental or suicidal. There was no note, but she died at age 20. She was a sophomore at Arizona State in Phoenix. And still visit her grave when we go to Phoenix, my wife and I, she's buried in Mesa, and we go visit her grave and decorate that. But yeah, pretty tragic ending to that story.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah, well, now tell me about if you had any survivor guilt afterwards. I mean, again, this is almost like a 9/11. You survived the Twin Towers or something, and then you have this whole thing about why me? Why did I go through this? I had an opportunity to speak with Dick Bass. Dick Bass is the first guy who actually climbed the Seven Summits. He's since passed, but he was the owner of Snowbird. And I went to a charity event that Steve Young held many years ago, and he had been in a helicopter skiing with his good buddy Frank Wells, who's the CEO of Disney, and they'd gone up with their wives on this helicopter skiing adventure and down in Utah, and they skied. The patrols came back and said, "Hey, let's go in early. We see a storm coming." They all jumped on the planes. At the very last second, his wife comes, she pounds on the side of the door. And this is Frank Wells' wife, and said, "Hey, I really feel more comfortable to fly down the hill with my husband." And so Dick Bass said, "Hey, no problem." Jumps out, goes to the other helicopter, jumps in with his wife. Off they take, and Frank Wells' helicopter crashes. And so now this is, you know, a month or two later, we end up at his resort. And he comes down, and he's talking to Steve Young, myself, and six other NFL guys, and he's reliving this story and just breaking down in tears, and a big vivacious guy. And he was just having a really hard time dealing with the survivor's guilt. Like, why me? Why was I chosen? Why did she pound on my door at the last second? Because I should be the one buried on the side of the mountain right now.
Yeah. I get that, Mark. I totally understand. I think that's a very good analogy from what I went through. Survivor's guilt is real. And you know what? I was warned it was going to happen to me, and I didn't believe that. I thought, what are these people talking about? I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I survived in the middle of a group of people who died in this plane crash where 112 people lost their lives. I should be the luckiest guy in the world. But after a couple of weeks, going on a month, I looked in the mirror and I couldn't see that guy. I had that guilt. And I think, especially for me, it came from the fact that it was a one-year-old boy. He was 18 months of age, sitting in the seat right in front of me, who died in the crash. I mean, we're 2.5 feet apart, and I survived without any serious injuries, and he dies. And he's got his whole life in front of him, and I'm 29 years old at the time. And that's the one I really wrestled with. It wasn't so much, you know, why did I survive? It was, why did I survive when this little boy died? He's playing peekaboo with me over the seat back. And one moment, next moment, we hit the ground, and he's over here, and he gets thrown from his seat, and he's dead. So that's what I really struggle with, and I still do a little bit today. I mean, it doesn't grab me all the time, but I still have some faint feelings of it. And it's for me, it was conquered by my faith, and that is, hey, I just came to the conclusion that God's got a perfect plan for me, and if he's going to have me crash in a plane, then that's his prerogative, and I'll just do whatever I can with that. So that's where I'm at.
Were you a man of faith before this, or did that incident amplify your beliefs from before of the, from why me to there's got to be a higher purpose?
No spiritual convictions at all before the crash, Mark, none. And the crash, as a result of the crash, I became a Christian and became a believer and started trusting God. So when I look back at the crash and think, you know, what are the good things that come from that? That's number one, my faith. And it wouldn't have happened probably without a plane crash. And, you know, I look back on it now and I think, here's what I see with that plane crash. I see God going, Jerry, I finally got your attention. It took 30 years in a plane crash, but I finally got your attention. And now that I do, I just want you to trust me for the rest of your life. So that's one of the reasons I survived the plane crash. And that's where I'm at today.
So I guess I would ask the question, you know, why to, in so many cases, it takes a life-threatening event for somebody to get their, I wouldn't say their life together, but get their priorities straight and what's most important and that there's a higher being. Well, why is that?
I think because we get set in our ways and we just refuse to change. I mean, that's the way I was. Mark, I thought I had it all figured out. I mean, I was 29 years old and I was a hotshot sportscaster and been on ESPN doing games at age 26, I think. And I thought I was on the path to being rich and famous. You know, I was going to be the best next Bob Costas or Al Michaels or somebody. And that was it. And that was my priority. And that was my focus in life. And nothing was going to get in the way of that until a plane crash came along. And that's what it took for me. It took a plane crash to get my attention because otherwise it wasn't going to happen. So I think it's just, I think for athletes, especially I was a baseball player in college and, you know, we think, you know, we got it figured out. The harder you work, the better you're going to be, no pain, no gain, you know, all that kind of stuff. You're just taught this is the way you have to do it and don't let anything get in your way. And if you get back down, pick yourself back up and all that, it doesn't work that way when tragedy hits. And I found that out the hard way.
Well, there's no question that however you want to slice it, you have gone on to do much greater things. And maybe that was a defining moment in your life. I'm sure it was. But, you know, certainly your focus, your drive, your desire to be the best, you know, person that you can be, not only with your faith, but also with your activities, your profession, have been, you know, just really remarkable. And I can only imagine the amount of lives that you've actually touched from this story and what that has meant to them, you know, really being open and vulnerable to, you know, how it all played out. And on top of that, and this is kind of where I want to segue into this next subject is, you know, again, let's go back to why you were on that plane in the first place. You were a broadcaster, I believe, in the Continental Basketball League. And so from there, then I don't know how soon after that, but then you actually did end up getting this platform many, many years as the broadcaster, play-by-play guy for the Colorado Rockies. Right?
Yep, exactly. Yep. Yeah, you got it right.
Yep. Yeah. Just making sure my numbers are right. And a couple of years for the Timberwolves. So, you know, I mean, again, that is, there's only so many of those jobs that are out there, right? And you happen to be the lucky ones to get. And now you, again, you get this platform. You now become the voice of people get to know you on a deeper level too, not just the play-by-play stuff. So what was that like transitioning? Obviously, you come away from that plane crash, but, you know, you've now got this kind of new perspective as you're launching into this new career.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're right about that. I got very fortunate when I got the Minnesota Timberwolves job, and that was about a year after the crash. And that's what I want to do. I want to be in the NBA. And then 2 years after that, I came to Denver and did the Nuggets for 18 years and the Rockies for 10. And so, I mean, what a career, 20 years in the NBA and 10 in Major League Baseball. How can anyone ever argue or complain about that sportscasting career? But I learned early on, Mark, that it was a platform, and you called it that, and that's a great description of it. It wasn't Jerry Schimmel doing games so that he could be patted on the shoulder and told how great he was, and I saw you on TV last night, and, you know, what a game and all that. It was so that I can get indoors that I wouldn't get in normally, that I could eventually lead to something like you're doing today, a podcast, and I'm able to share my story and maybe have some positive influence on somebody. So it wasn't about the money. It wasn't about the prestige. It was about, hey, now it's your platform. You can share and you can have an impact on somebody in a positive way. And that's the way I've looked at my career. And that's probably the way I'll look at the rest of my life.
Well, I mean, there's no question that I can't imagine some of the experiences you had, you know, broadcasting all those different games. I'm from Seattle. We used to have a team called the Seattle Supersonics. They had a lot of battles against the Nuggets. Kevin Calabro, I'm sure you know him. He was a legendary figure up there, and I think he recently retired. But, you know, what a class act, and again, another great platform for you. Where was it as you know, as you're doing these games, and certainly you have a love of sport, where you also wanted to, maybe this was an extension from your baseball, but you wanted to start getting into this whole cycling, you know, staying fit world, which ultimately led to this race, which I think went across the whole United States, which is insane.
It's not any more than insane than climbing Mount Everest. I can tell you that right now, my friend, or any of the seven summits. You know what it was? It goes back to the plane crash. Cycling does. For a couple of years after the crash, I just, you know, started with a little funk. I wasn't depressed or anything, but I was still thinking about the crash a lot. It was recommended to me to do some kind of physical activity on a regular basis that really might help with your therapy. And so I dusted off a bike that was in my garage, and I had done triathlons in younger days, my early 20s, and really liked the bike aspect of that. So I started riding my bike, and man, it just felt good, Mark. It just felt like, I don't know what it is about cycling, whether it's because you can go fast or you can cover a lot of ground, or you know, the sweat, the exertion, but I just felt like I was alive when I was cycling. And I just started doing it more and more, and I just fell in love with it, and then thought, you know, why don't you use this love of cycling to help other people, to raise money, kind of like you're doing with your mountain climbing. And I thought, all right, how can I do that? So I started doing races, and then I did a couple rides across America to raise money for different charities in Denver. And then 2015 did the actual race across America as part of a two-man relay team, and we're able to give an orphanage in Haiti about $100,000. It all stemmed from the plane crash, which a lot of stuff in my life has in the last 31 years. But cycling came from the plane crash and has led to some wonderful things.
You know, here's the one thing I love, and I heard this today, and I want to share this. The first time I've actually like thought of it this way. I happen to be doing all these, but I really believe in these four pillars. And I think, you know, listening to your story, you really have these things together, which is that the four pillars to really make somebody whole is doing physical fitness, which creates mental toughness, right? So I can't do it the other way. I've been with people who thought that they could read a bunch of books on how to become an expert mountain climber, but they haven't put in the physical work. So I've been on Mount Rainier a year and a half ago, where this person quit because they thought that they could learn all about mental, so they had the whole thing backwards, right? So one connects to the other. So for you, again, you know, you're out there, you're cycling, you're doing hardcore things. In fact, you actually cycled across the U.S. Number two is community, right? So your community could be your friends. It could be the community that you built up in the NBA over all those years, for the few years in the Major League Baseball as well. So that's so important to, you know, creating this whole person that also could have everything to do with your religion, with your beliefs. Certainly those tie together. Mother Nature. So for you, again, being out in nature, cycling, mountain biking, being where you can really just think and focus on what is clear in your head and where you need to go. And then the last one, which you just tied in, is mission. So your mission, again, is creating a charity to raise all this money, $100,000 plus for these people, these kids down in Haiti. I mean, it's incredible. And I think when you can start to think like that and paying forward your successes and teaching and learning and hanging out with those positive influences in your life, great things can happen.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think anybody who goes through a tragedy, following those four pillars is probably going to help you out of that. It might not eliminate the tragedy. It might not completely pull you out of that hole. But boy, if you follow what you just described, Mark, I think you're going down the right path. So I'm with you. And like you said, it starts with physical exertion, and that's what it did with me. And I love it. I can't get enough of it.
Yeah, I tell you one thing. I've solved so many problems in my head when I've been going up and down in Mother Nature.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, if something's on my mind and bothering me, I've been through tough times myself. It has not always been butterflies and rainbows for me. So really trying to get calm and get silent. And while I'm out exercising to create and fire those pistons in my head to like, how actually am I going to get through this whole thing? You've written a couple books, so you're a very accomplished guy. I want to ask you about Choose to Live. It's an interesting title, and it's interesting to me because I choose to live, but there's many people out there that choose to be either stuck in quicksand, or they're not really moving the ball, or they get comfortable with what they're doing. And facing your fears, stepping into that, challenging yourself. I mean, all those things is just, to me, that's life, and there's so much to live. Tell me more about that book and kind of what the motivation behind that. I mean, it sounds like it was an extension from the plane crash.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's kind of goes back and recounts my story of the plane crash and more probably life after that, Mark, and what I had to deal with, and the journey, my spiritual journey, is in the book as well. But you know, the reason I wrote it was I just thought I've got a message for people, and that is, if you're still breathing and still living, then there's hope for you. And so as long as you're doing that, let's go out and really live it. So let's come out of our comfort zone. Let's do things that we never thought we could do before. Let's maybe not do the seven summits or race across America, but let's do our equivalent of that. Because Mark, I think everybody has, I know everybody's got something in their life they've thought about doing and they've never done it. You probably thought about mountain climbing forever and then finally acted on it. I thought about riding my bike across the country and 15 years later, finally pulled the trigger on it. Everybody's got that. And I think I tell people that ran Race Across America that did in 2015 is a great metaphor for life. And it goes back to the book, and that is to live life to its fullest. I think it's a great metaphor. Ram was really hard. It's a bike race from the West Coast to the East Coast, 3,000 miles. And we did it in 2015. The weather was crazy. And it was 113 degrees in the Mojave Desert day one. In the last 3 days, it never stopped raining. I'm serious. It never stopped raining for 3 days. We just kind of followed the thunderstorm across the country. And it was really hard. And we didn't sleep. And the crew was tired. And we had roadblocks and flooding and all this stuff. But when we got to the end, the reward for that was absolutely incredible. And I think that's what life is. If we take a chance, if we step out there, come out of our comfort zone and give this thing a shot, it's not going to be easy. It's going to be really hard, like Ram was. It's going to be really hard, like Mount Everest is going to be for you. And I think it's for everybody that has something they've always wanted to do and they've never done before. But, you know, I think just it's a great metaphor for life. Ram was hard. It was really difficult. But we made it through when we got to the finish line. And more importantly, I think, Mark, is the person you become, the change that you have inside you in the journey. Reaching Mount Everest is going to be awesome, but your journey to get there is a whole nother story. And that's where change comes. Change doesn't come from you getting to the top of the mountain and cheering. The change comes from what you did along the way to get there. The change for me was not getting the finish line at Ram or doing it again as a solo racer. It was all the things I did leading up to that changed me.
Yeah. So I go through this a lot when I'm on these different mountains, and I've been on, I'll give an example on Aconcagua. It's a mountain down in Argentina, 23,000 feet. We started with 12 people, only six made it. And several times in these different journeys, we have been at a certain point where, as you just said, it gets hard and it gets really hard and awful things, you know, between weather, somebody falling in a crevasse, avalanche, whatever, they all seem to present themselves. And people want to quit. And I keep thinking in my mind, and I've talked to other people about this, I mean, think about where you're going to be in 12 hours or 24 hours. I mean, you're going to be sitting back in the hotel, having a beer or whatever you do, right? And this hard moment is going to be over. And it's so much about life is that if you can just find a way to get through it, you can get to the other side, but you got to stick in there. You can't quit. And that's a lot of the reason why the name of this podcast is called Finding Your Summit. It's not about finding an actual summit. It's about everybody's on their own quest, but you got to seek and you got to go after it. And that's then what makes you a better person in life. And the experiences that you can have along the way, as you talked about, the journey is all worth it once you get there. I mean, it's amazing. And I don't think it ever has to stop. People say to me, you know, okay, so you do the seven summits, is that it? And the answer is no, man, I got so many more things I want to do, just because I've just seen this miracle of people presented into my life like you right now. If I hadn't gone through my adversity and started climbing mountains and started doing this and that, I wouldn't have started a podcast, which ultimately wouldn't have led to you, right? And hearing this amazing story. And that's just, I've got so many examples of action, creating reaction, and never giving up along the way, right? That's, I don't know. I mean, that's been, it's been just one of the great gifts of my life.
Yeah. No, I think it's easy for people to come up with excuses. I know for some it's, you know, I'm too old. Well, I just interviewed a 78-year-old guy who did Mount Everest. So you can't say that you're too old. Well, I can't do it because I have a physical disability. I interviewed a guy, you probably know Eric Weinmayer, who's the blind person who climbed Mount Everest. I mean, if he can climb Mount Everest blind, why can't I do something like that? I met a guy who's an NCAA wrestling champion who was born with one leg. He went to Arizona State, won a national wrestling championship, beat the defending champion from Iowa in the 125-pound. And if an NCAA wrestler can win a championship with one leg, then, you know, I could ride my bike across the country. So I just think it's easy to come up with excuses. It's hard to do the event, but it's easy to come up with excuses, and it's really easy to quit. The hard thing is to keep going. The hardest thing is to pull the trigger in the first place and start. And then it's easy to quit after that and hard to keep going, but the rewards for keep on going, getting to the end, are just absolutely incredible.
I love it all. Love your story. Love your outlook on life. You've got another book too, Extravagant Gift. And this is another book that you did in 2009. Really quickly, what is that about?
Yeah, it's basically a booklet. It's an evangelical outreach tool. It's a real clear and concise message of the gospel, at least I think it is. It's something, and I found in trying to tell people about Jesus that it was difficult, it was intimidating, but I found if I wrote this book that takes about 5 minutes to read through, it is non-threatening, non-intimidating. I just handed people and say, hey, read this book, and you know, if you have any questions, let me know, or let me know what you think. So that's the reason I wrote the book, and it's been a great outreach tool for me. I've been able to reach a lot of people through that little booklet for the gospel, which again is one of the reasons I think I survived the crash.
Well, I think it's people like you that make the planet a better place. And then we've been going through a lot of chaos, you know, in this last year or two politically. And I think the more people that are doing the things that you're doing, trying to make the world a better place, doing by example, leading by example, writing books, spreading positive messages, you know, it just helps everybody around, you know, just make this planet a better place to live, right? Where can people find you?
I'm at jerryschimmel.com. So if somebody wants to contact me, they can just go to my website. That's probably the best place to do it. There's lots of information there, but my email address is there, jerryschimmel.com, Jerry, and then S-C-H-E-M-M-E-L.
Great. Now, I assume that's where you can find the books too, correct?
Yep.
Awesome.
Yes, sir.
All right, Jerry, listen. It's been a pleasure. It's been an honor to have you on the pod today. You've got so many great things going on, and to listen to this harrowing story of you surviving the plane crash and going on to doing so many great things in life. I'm so glad you survived and you've gone on to do those things. So thank you for coming on.
You bet. Thank you, my friend. I appreciate it. Hey, and all the best to you when you get back over to Asia and climb that mountain. I'll be pulling for you.
Right on. All right. There he is. The one, the only Jerry Schimmel. Thank you.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, NFL.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.